When Eos, the early-born child, appeared, Rose Fingers, the dawn, he roused himself right out of bed, Odysseus' own son, dressed himself in clothes, and set his sharp sword round his shoulder. Under his glistening feet he bound beautiful sandals, and made his exit out the chamber like a god face to face. Right away he gave orders to the heralds with their shrill voices to summon to market the proud heads of hair, Achaeans. The one group cried the summons, the other gathered right quick. But when they were gathered, and one gathering they became, he made his move into the market, in his hand holding a coppered spear. Not alone, with him were two white hounds following. Wondrous indeed, on him at least, was the grace Athena shed. That was a man the entire people marveled at as he approached. He sat in his father's seat, and the senators gave way. Among them, then, the hero Aegyptius began the speaking, a man who was bent with old age, and he knew innumerable things. For it was this man's own son, with God's match Odysseus, went to Ilium of the fine foals within the hollow ships, Antiphus the spearman, him the brutish Circuli killed in a hollowed cave, the last man he fixed for dinner. There were three other sons, even one who would hang out with the suitors, Eurynomus, while two always kept the paternal farms. But even so, he could not forget that one, moaning and mourning. He was shedding a tear for him when he spoke out among them. "Take a listen now to me, Ithacesians, whatever I may say. Never have we had our assembly or council sit from the time Odysseus, radiant, went in the hollow ships. Now who is it has gathered us so? What need so great has come, whether from the new-made men or among the senior men in the front? Has he heard some news of an army on the way, which he might be able to clarify for us in that he sooner got wind of it? Or is there some other public matter he can make known, even make a speech about? He looks to be a gentleman, privileged. May it be for himself that Zeus fulfill a good thing, whatever it is he intends within his breath's vessel." So he spoke, and he took joy in the utterance, Odysseus' own dear son. Nor indeed did he stay seated for long, but got excited to make his speech. He stood up in mid-assembly. The scepter was put in his hand by the herald Peisenor, who knew sense in his bollocks. First, then, he spoke to the old man, grafting onto his words.
"Elder, he's not far, this man. You'll know him soon enough yourself, the one who gathered the people. On me most of all does grief and grievance come. No, I didn't hear any news of an army on the way, which I may tell you clearly in that I learned of it sooner. Nor is there some other public matter I can disclose or politicize, but my own present need, which is the evils that befell my household in two ways. On the one hand, I lost outright a noble father, who once among you, you very men in front of me, was your king, as kind as a father. But now, and this is a much greater one, that in a moment the entire household will be destroyed altogether, a livelihood completely ruined. My mother's suitors harass her against her will, the own sons of these men who are the best in these parts, who shrink in cold fear from returning to her father's house, Icarius, so that he himself might shower and dower his daughter, and give her to whom he likes, and the one who comes most pleasing to himself. But these men come and go round our place, day in and day out, sacrifice cattle and sheep and fat goats as they party on as though at a hosted banquet, and quaff the flame-eyed wine with no excuse. The most of it is wasted, for there is no man around, such as Odysseus used to be, to protect the house from disgrace. We are not now in any way capable of defending it, and even in future we shall be weakling wretches, untrained and unskilled in the bravery of war. Sure, I would defend myself if the power were in me, for deeds have been done that can no longer be borne, and it's no longer on the up and up that my house is destroyed. Shame on yourselves as well. Show respect before others, regard for what the neighbours think, who are settled round about. Oh, but tremble your knees at the wrath of the gods, lest they turn after you somehow, flabbergasted at the evil doings. I beg you by Zeus Olympian, but also by Themis Custom, who governs the assemblies of men. She dissolves them, but also seats them. Stop it, friends. Don't leave me to erode away, all alone in my grief and mourning, unless some way, somehow, my father, the noble Odysseus, with bad intent, did evil by the men in Greaves, Achaeans, in payback for which you're doing me evil, intentionally, by urging these men on. As for me, it would be more profitable if it was you, not them, ate up the stores and the flocks. If it was you did the eating, soon enough there would be a payment, for meanwhile down in the town we could greet each other with a mutual disclosure, asking for our stuff back until everything was returned. But as it is, you're casting pains into my life's breath without recourse.
So he spoke in dudgeon, and he threw the sceptre upon the earth, bursting out in tears. Pity took hold of the whole congress. Then everyone else was silent, nor did a one of them dare to take Telemachus' place with harsh and stern disclosures. Antinous alone took his place and spoke to him. "Telemachus, you ponce! Crazy man, what are you saying? Trying to shame us? You'd like to pin the blame on us. But there's no way it's the suitors among we Achaeans who are at fault by you, but your own mother, who's a woman knows the profit in cunning. For this is already the third year, and on comes the fourth, since she's been cheating the life's breath in the chests of the Achaeans. She gives hope to all of us, and makes promises to each man singly, sending out messages, but her thought intends otherwise. And there's this trick, this other one, she turned over in her mind's vessel. She stood up a great loom and began weaving a web in her chambers, finely threaded and at great scale. Right away she spoke among us.
Young lads, my wooers, seeing as he died, radiant Odysseus, leave off pressuring this marriage of mine, at least until I finish the cloak, lest my homespun come to nothing and is wasted. For Laertes the hero, his shroud, against the time when the deadly allotment of death takes him down and lays him low, lest some Achaean daughter down the suburbs cast aspersions, if he lies down without a wrapping, though he'd made it rich.
So she spoke, and on our side the manly spirit was persuaded. Then, even as by day she would weave the great loom, by night she would pick it apart when she'd got torches by. So for 3 years she got away with her trick and persuaded the Achaeans. That when the fourth year came and the seasons arrived on time, only then did one of her women let on, who knew the business, and we caught her in the act, unravelling the splendid loom. That's how she completed the thing, unwilling, mind, by compulsion. As for you, this is how the suitors make answer, so that you know it yourself in your own life's breath, and that all the Achaeans may know. Send back that mother of yours. Command her to be wedded to whomever the father pushes and is pleasing to herself. And if she will continue to frustrate and string along the sons of the Achaeans, thinking uppity thoughts in her life's breath, because Athena gave her generously to know how to make gorgeous works and
excellent brains to profit by them, the like of no other woman we hear about, not even among the ancients, those women who once upon a time were the fair tresses, Achaean alumnae, Tyro and Alcmene, and Mycenae of the beautiful coronal. None of these new thoughts the like of those Penelope knows. But you know this time she did not think so smartly, for meanwhile it's your very livelihood and possessions being eaten up. While that woman indulges this mindset, whatever it is now the gods have put in her chest. Great the fame for herself that she fashions, but for you, the longing for a massive lost living. For our part, no to our old farms. We're not going anywhere until at least she marries an Achaean, whichever one she likes. Then, in turn, Telemachus faced him and said,
Antinous, how is it possible to push her from the house against her will? She who bore me, she who raised me. My father's in another world. He's alive, or maybe he's dead. A bad business for me to pay so much back to Icarius, if on my own and by my will I should send back mother. For I shall suffer bad things from her father, and others that the god will bequeath when mother prays down the hateful Erinues as she exits the home. The indignation of mankind upon me, that's what's next. So I shall never say this thought of mine. But you, if your life's breath finds fault with these things, get out of my rooms. Provision other meals, eating up your own stores, taking turns by households. But if this seems to you the better and more virtuous way to be, to destroy a single man's livelihood without a price, go ahead, have at it. But I personally shall cry out to the gods who are forever. If ever Zeus allows that acts of payback come about, then for free would you be destroyed inside the house.
So spoke Telemachus, and broad-faced Zeus sent him 20 eagles ahead, swooping down from high on a mountain peak. For a while the pair soared in formation with the breaths of the wind, right next to one another with their wings outstretched. But when they reached the middle of the assembly, now with many voices raised, just there they wheeled round and flapped wings thick and fast, and looked in, the pair of them, on the heads of all, and the people stared down death. They tore at cheeks with their talons and necks on both sides, then darted up to the right through the households and their city. They stood amazed at the birds when they saw that in their eyeline, and they fretted in their life's breath what in fact was to be fulfilled. Among them there spoke an old man, the hero Halitherses, Mastor's son, for he stood out alone in his generation for reading the bird omens and revealing what was appropriate. That was he who, loyal to them, addressed the assembly and spoke in their midst.
Hear me now, Ithacusians, whatever I shall say. But it's the suitors in particular I point to when I say this. For a great boulder of misery is rolling upon them. Why? Not long will Odysseus be far from his home near and dear, but somewhere round already he's near. Right by this lot here. He's plotting a field of slaughter and death for the whole lot of them, and for many of the rest of us as well. He'll be an evil, what with our allotments on conspicuous Ithaca. But let's get the jump. Let's think about it, how we could put a stop to it. But these men on their own, let them cease and desist. Why, even for them, this is the better thing. Why? Because I'm no novice at prophesying. No, I know my stuff. And because I declared to the man himself that everything would be fulfilled, just as I was revealing it to him when they were going on board for Ilium, the Argives, and he followed after,
Polywily Odysseus. I declared that, having suffered many evils and utterly lost all his companions, unknown and unknowable to all, yea, in the 20th year he shall come home. That is what is now, all of it, being fulfilled. Him then Eurymachus, Polybus' son, faced and said,
Old man, come off it. Prophesy at your children. Go home. Shame if something bad should happen them later. As for this, it's me rather than you that's a whole lot better at soothsaying. Birds, there's rather a lot of them under the rays of the sun, busy here and there, and not all of them mean something. As for Odysseus, he's destroyed far away, just as you also ought to have been perished with him. If only. Not so much to prophesy then, in public, nor could you so unleash Telemachus, who's already angry, in hopes of a gift for your own house, if he's giving. But I'll tell you straight, and this is a thing that will be fulfilled. If you, who know the old sayings, and no end, are going at a ripe young lad with your wheedling tropes to set him on to violence, first of all, it'll be all the worse for the guy himself, and he won't be able to do anything about it all the same, precisely because of this lot here. But as for you, old man, we'll slap you with a fine, the paying of which will hurt you where you live. Violent, yes, will be your grief. For Telemachus, between all of you and me, I'll make a suggestion on my own. That mother of his, let him command her to go back to her father's. It's they who'll set up a wedding and organize the dowry, a huge one, as befits the travel package of a dear daughter. For I suspect that not before then will the sons of the Achaeans desist from grievous wooing, since there's nobody we're afraid of in any case. So not Telemachus, howsoever loquacious he is, nor do we give a shit about a prophecy, anything which you, oldster, expound without fulfilment, and make yourself hated all the more. At the end of the day, his stuff gets eaten up, and never an equation will there be, while that woman exhausts the Achaeans, delaying her marriage. For our part, we'll hang around day after day, because she's fine. We'll fight for her, not after other women shall we go, ones whom it would be our right, each of us, to hook up with. Him, then, honest Telemachus faced and said, Eurymachus and the rest of you, your noble suitors, this I'll no longer entreat of you, nor make a speech, for the gods already know the business and all the Achaeans. But come, give me a quick ship and a companion crew of 20, who could accomplish the journey for me hither and thither, for I am going to Sparta, and also Sandy Pylos, to hear of the return home of a father who's long been gone, in case some punter talks to me, or I shall hear a rumour from Zeus, which most often brings the headlines to people. If I should hear of father's living and his return home, well then, it'd wear me out, but I'd still make it through a year. But if I should hear of him as dead and no longer living, then, of course, I'd return home to the mother earth of my fathers, and I'd heap up his burial mound and arrange his funeral gifts, a good many, as much as suits, and I shall give mother to a man. That's how he spoke, you see, and sat down. And among them stood up Mentor, who was an ally of blameless Odysseus, even the one to whom he entrusted all his household when he went on the ships. Obey my old man and guard everything securely. Meaning them well, this man addressed the assembly and said among them, So hear me now, Ithacesians, what I shall say.
May there never again be a well-meaning, kind and gentle, scepter-holding king, nor one who reasons the right in his mind's vessel, but let him always be violent and work out his insolence, seeing as no one remembers how Odysseus the godly, over the peoples he used to serve as lord, was as kindly as a father. Mind you, I grudge them nothing, the manly wooers, acting out their compulsions in the dissonant rhythms of their mentality, for they stake their own heads when violently they devour the house of Odysseus, the man they claim will never return. No, at this point I blame the rest of the populace, the way you all sit there in silence, not a sign of you getting the nerve to speak, and putting a stop to a sorry shift of suitors when you're the majority. And him Euenor's son Leocritus faced and said, Mentor, you mouth breather, crazy in the head, what are you saying? Urging us to leave off. It's a grievous thing to start a fight with real men who've also got the numbers over a meal. For if Odysseus the Ithacesian were really to come himself among the diners in his own house, the manly suitors, and be eager in his life's breath to drive them out the hall, his own wife would not be best pleased. Consider the strength of her needs. At his arrival, but right then and there, would he meet with an unseemly fate if he fought against numbers. You spoke out of your depth. Enough of this, people. Scatter off to your farms, each of you. This man's journey, Mentor will speed it, yes, and Halitherses. These were his father's allies right from the start. Mind you, I suspect for some time yet, he'll be sitting round here in Ithaca, listening for news, and he'll never complete this trip. So he uttered and broke up the assembly right quick. A part of them scattered, each to his own house, but the suitors went to the house of gods Odysseus. And Telemachus went off afar to the shore of the sea, washed his hands in the grey brine, and made prayer to Athena.
Hear me, yesterday's god, you who came to our house and ordered me in a ship over the foggy deep to learn while on the road the return home of my father, so long gone. But the Achaeans are hindering the whole business, the suitors especially, the horrid bullies.
So he spoke in prayer, and right next him came Athena, seeming to be Mentor, not just in build, but in her speech as well. And she filled her voice and addressed him lines with wings. Telemachus, you're not going to turn out a bad sort or a stupid, if in fact the fluid sap of your father has in you been instilled. Such a man he was, to perfect both the act and the line. So your salt sea road will not be barren of accomplishment. But if you are not the scion of that man and of Penelope, then I shouldn't have thought that you could still achieve what you have in mind. For your children are few that turn out comparable to their dad. The most of them are worse, but there's a few turn out better than the father. But since in the aftermath you will not be a madman, nor a stupid, and it is not altogether the case that the kenning of Odysseus has abandoned you, there is hope for you yet to accomplish these tasks. Therefore now, never mind the suitors, their plot and their plan. Senseless men, since they're no way intelligent, nor either just, nor are they aware at all about death and the blackness of death's shape. A man who is already nearby, so they die all on a day. But the journey will no longer be a distant thing which you're wanting, for I am such an ally for you. Your father's man is who I am, who shall fit out your quick ship, and I myself shall come along. Right, you go home and mingle with the suitors. Provision grains, and fit everything in jars with lids, wine in the two-handled ones, and barley, the marrow of real men, in tight skins. My job will be after a local crew. I'll quickly gather the volunteers. There's ships around, many in sea-flanked Ithaca, new ones and old. I shall personally check them out, find the one that's the very best, and we'll fit her up sharpish and put out into the wide sea deep." So spoke Athena, daughter of Zeus, and not for long, no doubt, did Telemachus hang around once he'd heard the voice of a god. He made for the house, stressed in his own heart, and of course he found the manly wooers in his rooms, fixing to flay goats and singeing swine in the courtyard. Antinous came right at Telemachus with a laugh, grafted onto him with his hand, spoke a line, and called it what it was.
"Telemachus, you talker, wild man, let's not have another bad thing trouble you in your chest in the doing and the saying, but eat with me and have a drink, just like before. All this business of yours, the Achaeans will jolly well finish it, the ship and picked oarsmen, so you come the quicker into sacred Pylos, after news of your vaunted father."
Him then honest Telemachus faced and said,
"Antinous, there's no way possible among arrogant assholes like you to sit and eat in silence and have an easy good time. Isn't it enough how, in the past, you wasted so many quality things? My stuff, suitors, moochers, and me, I was only a child. But now, when I'm all big, and I hear what others express, and start to learn for myself, you better believe my life's breath grows within me, and I shall try such things. You owl coward's death's upon you, whether I've gone to Pylos first or stayed right here in the neighbourhood. Yes, I'm going, and it's going to be no salt barren road is what I'm saying out loud, even as a passenger, for no possessor of ship nor oarsmen did I turn out to be. So I suppose now it seemed more profitable to you that way."
He spoke and drew his hand from the hand of Antinous, nice and easy. As for the suitor looters, they worked on the meal in the house, and they kept making fun and mocking him with their lines. Thus would one of the young bullies say,
"Well, well, Telemachus is plotting the murder of us. Maybe out of Pylos he'll bring back some fighters, Sandy over there, or even out of Sparta. See, the fellow's pretty keepy keen. Or just maybe he fancies a trip to Ephyre's bountiful ploughland to import from there some life-destroying herbal pharmaceuticals, throw them in the wine bowl, and kill a lot of us at once."
And another of the young bullies would say in turn,
"Who knows? What if himself goes alone on a hollow ship and is destroyed far from his own, wandering around just like Odysseus? So he swells our labour all the more, for we would have to divvy up the property, all of it. But the house, well, we'd give it to the fellow's mother to keep, as well as the one who bags her."
So they spoke. But he proceeded down to the high-roofed chamber of his father, broad and wide, where the piled-up gold and copper lay, clothing in chests and plenty of fragrant olive oil. There were big jars of wine of a sweet drinking vintage, stood up within, harbouring inside an unmixed divine potation, fitted to the supporting wall in order, in case Odysseus should make his return home after suffering many griefs. Bolted shut were the doors, closely fitted, one to the other. Inside a manager woman, day and night, would keep it, who guarded everything with a mind that knows a thing or two, Eurycleia, daughter of Ops, son of Peisenor. She it was then Telemachus addressed, once he'd called her to the chamber.
"Nana, come draw me some wine into amphoras, the nice stuff, whichever has the second best bouquet after the one you guard, expecting that ill-fated man, in case he ever comes, sprung of Zeus, Odysseus, escaped from death and its shapes. Fill 12 full and fit them all with lids.
pour me some barley into well-stitched skin bags. Let's say there be 20 measures of stone-ground barley meal. Yourself alone can know this. Let everything be gathered together, for in the evening I myself shall pick it up, whenever, actually, mother ascends to her upper chamber and makes her plans for bed. For I shall go to Sparta, and also to Pylos, all sanded up, to learn the return home of my father, if I hear it from somewhere.
So he spoke, and she shrieked, "Dear nurse Eurycleia," and while she wept, she addressed him lines with wings. "What's the matter, you dear child? How'd this plan turn up in your lungs? Where do you want to be going over the wide planet, only child as you are and bosom loved? The man was killed far from his father's land, sprung from Zeus, Odysseus, an unknown, lost among foreigners. And these men here, as soon as you're gone, will be plotting evil after, how to kill you by cunning, and they'll divide all this store themselves. No, you just sit down here on top of your own. There's no need for you to suffer ills upon the unfruited deep, nor to wander blind."
Her then, honest Telemachus faced and said, "Courage, Nana, since it's not without God, you see, not this plan here. But swear not to disclose this matter to my mother until the 11th, maybe the 12th day comes, or else when she misses me herself and hears about my setting off, I don't want her crying and degrading the beauty of her skin." That's how he spoke, and the old lady swore a great oath by the gods. But no sooner had she sworn and completed the oath, immediately she began drawing his wine into two-handled jars, and she poured his barley into well-stitched-up skins. But Telemachus went into the house and mingled with the suitors. Then she turned her thought to other things, the goddess, Owl-Eyes Athena. Looking like Telemachus, she went all over downtown, and she stood by each bloke and passed the word, ordering them, come evening, to gather by the swift ship. And then she thought of Phronius' splendid son Noemon, asked of him said swift ship, and the man loyally promised it her. The sun he went down, all the streets grew shadowed, and just then she dragged the swift ship to the sea, and within it she placed all the tackle, all the stuff that ships with benches carry. She stationed it at the edge of the harbour, and round about the excellent crew were gathering in a group. The goddess gave each man a pep talk. Then again she turned her thought to other things, Owl-Eyes Athena. She made her way to the house of gods Odysseus. Once there, upon the suitors, she shed a sweet sleep, struck them while they were drinking, tipped out the cups from their hands. They roused themselves to go to bed in the town, and it wasn't very long they sat there once the sleep fell upon them in their eyelids. But Telemachus she spoke to, Owl-Eyes Athena. She called him out in front of the well-founded palace, the very image of Mentor, not just in build, but also in voice. "Telemachus, already your men in greaves, your crew, are sat at the oars, awaiting the push from you. Come off it, let's go. Let's not hang around, delaying the trip." So having spoken thus, she took the lead, Pallas Athena, stepping rapidly, and he walked after, in the footsteps of the god. But once they got down to the ship and to the sea, next they found by the shore the companion crew, proud heads of hair, and among them spoke his virile highness, Telemachus. "Right, O friends, let's haul the stores, for everything is already piled up in the chamber. That mother of mine hasn't got wind of a thing, nor the other female servants. One alone has heard the word." So he said that and led them, and the rest followed with him. They did indeed carry everything to the ship with benches built in, and set it down as he ordered, Odysseus' own son. Of course Telemachus boarded the ship, but Athena was the captain, and in the ship's stern she sat herself down,
and sure enough, right next to her, there sat Telemachus. The men untied the stern cables and themselves boarded as well and sat down on the planks. And for them a traveller's wind, she sends it, Owl Eyes Athena, a strong breeze out the west, blustering over the drunken deep. Telemachus urged on his crew, ordered them to take hold of the tackle, and they heeded his urging. They raised the mast of pine within the hole in the beam midship. They stood it fixed and tied it down with forestays. They hauled up the white sail with well-twisted thongs of oxhide, and the wind filled the middle of the sail, and on both sides the wave crashed purple, roaring round the keel as the ship made its way. And she ran down the wave, cutting through on her route. Then once they tied down the tackle, up and down the ship, quick and black, they set up mixing bowls, brimming with wine, and were pouring libation to the deathless gods, born once and forever. But out of all of them, most especially to Zeus's Owl Eyes, his daughter. So all night long then, and even through dawn, that ship cut its way.